Hello, I'm Dr. Joel Gelfand, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome you and thank you for joining today's educational activity titled Shared Decision-Making and Optimal Care of Psoriasis and Digital Tools, Making It Work in Practice. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, who is celebrating their 100th live webcast today. CME Outfitters is a best-in-class accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians across the globe. The target audience for this program is dermatologists, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, nurses, pharmacists, and all members of the care team who aim to provide optimal care for patients with psoriasis. As I mentioned, I'm Dr. Joel Gelfand, Professor of Dermatology and Epidemiology and Vice Chair of Clinical Research and Medical Director of the Dermatology Clinical Studies Unit and Director of the Psoriasis and Phototherapy Treatment Center at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine here in Philadelphia. I look forward to our discussion today, which will focus on comprehensive patient-centered care in psoriasis, including the use of digital health tools. I'm excited about our program, and we're going to share some best practices and we'll provide some tips that any of you can integrate into your practice. Let me introduce our faculty joining me today. First, let me welcome Ms. Jangmi Johnson. She is the past president of the Illinois Society of Dermatology Physician Assistants and Senior Physician Assistant Certified and practices in the Illinois Dermatology Institute in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome, Jangmi.
Thank you, Dr. Gelfand.
And also let me introduce Dr. Junko Takeshita. Dr. Takeshita is Assistant Professor of Dermatology and Epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania, Perelman School of Medicine, again here in Philadelphia. Welcome, Junko.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me begin today's discussion with a case. This should be showing on your screen. This is a patient named JB. She's a 30-year-old female presenting with plaque psoriasis affecting her scalp, her trunk, her elbows, her knees, the genital area, and also has fingernail involvement with pitting and onycholysis. She has about 12% of her body involved with psoriasis and a global assessment of about 3, which means she has moderately red, thick, and scaly plaques. She's had symptoms for about 5 years and has been self-medicating with over-the-counter treatments. She has a very demanding job with long hours, making it hard for her to manage her psoriasis. And she complains that she has trouble sleeping because the itching from her psoriasis wakes her up at night. When we ask her about her joint symptoms, she notes that she has some pain in her knees and that they ache. She's also overweight with a BMI over 30, putting her in the obese category. So I want to engage our clinicians watching today. You should see the question on your screen. How would you treat this patient, JB? Please give us your response now, and we'll review those responses shortly. Our first learning objective is about employing a proactive approach to the management of patients with moderate to severe psoriasis who are not responding to current treatments. Junko, let's jump right into this today by discussing current therapies. There's so many advances going on. Tell us about the current treatments available for both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis.
Sure. So this slide is showing the currently available treatment options for psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. And we're really fortunate in this day to have so many treatment options for both conditions. If we look at the psoriasis treatment options first, our general approach is really to look at disease severity and offer our patients with more severe disease either phototherapy or systemic agents. And of those systemic agents, we have the conventional oral treatments listed there, and then a newer oral treatment, the small molecule PDE4 inhibitor. Now, amongst the biologics alone, we have a number of treatment options, and those can be broken down into classes of treatment targets. So there's the anti-TNF inhibitors, there are the IL-17 inhibitors, the IL-12 and 23 inhibitors, and then the IL-23 inhibitors. Now, if we go to the psoriatic arthritis treatment options, we have a similar sort of class of treatment options with the conventional oral systemics, newer oral treatments, again, including the PDE4 inhibitor, and then a JAK inhibitor that is a psoriatic arthritis treatment option, but not approved for psoriasis. And then a number of similar biologic options, again, the TNF inhibitors, IL-17 inhibitors, and the IL-12/23 inhibitor. In addition, CD80/86 inhibitor, which is not a treatment option for psoriasis.
Yeah, I think what's striking about all these expanding options is the new ACR-MPF guidelines suggesting that now TNF inhibitors should be first line for psoriatic arthritis, changing your paradigm for what used to be starting with methotrexate, for example, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is quite a contrast to the other treatment guidelines that have been in play in the past, and I think is a nice addition, giving us additional treatment options and support to start with TNF inhibitors for those with active psoriatic arthritis.
Yeah, so many different treatments coming to market now. Maybe we could start looking at some clinical data, Junko, looking at, say, secukinumab, IL-17 inhibitors. Tell us a little about what our listeners should know about for these classes of drugs.
Sure. So if we start with secukinumab is one of the IL-17 inhibitors. Showing you here is data from a head-to-head trial. And we're really seeing a lot more head-to-head trials for psoriasis treatment options these days. And so that's nice to see direct comparison. And so here we're seeing a direct comparison to ustekinumab. The two outcomes we're looking at here are the PASI 90, or at least 90% improvement, and PASI 100, meaning completely clear skin. So we're seeing the percentage of responders with each of these outcomes. And what you can see here is that secukinumab is superior to ustekinumab. We see secukinumab in the green. And the really unique thing about the IL-17 inhibitors are they're really fast acting. So you see a quick response, and you see it separating from ustekinumab as early as week 4. And we see a similar pattern with ixekizumab as well. Again, early response and superior to ustekinumab.
Yeah, I think I really want to emphasize how rapidly IL-17 inhibitors work. I find that especially gratifying in clinical practice. Many of my patients have struggled with their disease for 20 or more years, haven't lived a day of their life without psoriasis since it started. And I like to bring them back early in clinical practice, usually after 3 to 4 weeks of starting an IL-17, because it's just an amazing thing to experience with someone, that they've went from living with this disease for so long, failing so many treatments, only having partial responses, and then, you know, having such a rapid improvement in their skin disease. It's really an amazing thing to witness as a physician.
Yeah, it's a really nice treatment addition for our patients.
And so beyond the IL-17s, we continue to make progress. Tell us a little more about the IL-23 inhibitors.
Yeah, so the IL-23 inhibitors are also performing well. We're going to start with the newest addition to the market, which is tildrakizumab. This is actually showing a placebo-controlled trial. We see the tildrakizumab arms in the red, sort of darker orange and lighter orange there. We're looking at a different outcome here, which is actually the percentage of people achieving clear or almost clear skin according to the Physician Global Assessment score, so slightly different than the previous outcome. We do see that tildrakizumab is performing well. In data not shown here, it was also compared in a head-to-head trial to etanercept and was superior to etanercept. Mm-hmm. We also have guselkumab, which was the first IL-23 inhibitor to come to market. And what I really like about this trial is that this trial really reflects what we see in clinical practice and the questions that we have in clinical practice. And so what this trial did was initially started patients on treatment with ustekinumab. And at week 16, those who were not having an adequate response to ustekinumab were re-randomized to either receive guselkumab or stay on ustekinumab. And so here we're going back and looking at the PASI 90 and PASI 100 responses again, and we see in the light blue, in the guselkumab arm, patients are having added benefit when they switch to guselkumab, despite having an inadequate response to ustekinumab.
Yeah, I really like this clinical trial because it really asks a clinically meaningful question that we deal with in clinical practice. You know, a lot of us like ustekinumab. It works quite well, but not all patients have a great response to it. And the question is, well, what should I do next? And I use another IL-23 inhibitor. And what that data basically tells us is that, in fact, if someone has a partial response to ustekinumab, they still could do even better by adding or switching them to guselkumab, despite the fact that they have somewhat similar mechanisms of actions. And I think there's two schools of thoughts here. One is that with ustekinumab blocking IL-12 and 23, there's some thinking that blocking IL-12 may counteract the benefits of blocking IL-23, or it could be that the antibody is more avid and more successful at blocking IL-23 activity in guselkumab. Now, despite all the advances in biologics or injectable medications, many of my patients will say, you know what, Dr. Gelfand, I don't want to take an injectable medication. I don't like needles, or I just don't feel comfortable with the idea of having to inject something into my body. We have advances in oral medications as well. Tell us a little about what we're learning from apremilast.
Sure. I similarly sometimes have patients who are needle phobic and also ask about oral treatments instead. And so what we have is apremilast. This is our newest oral treatment. And this is, again, a placebo-controlled trial here. And we're looking at the outcome, again, of clear, almost clear skin. And we do see that apremilast has moderate efficacy here. Looking at week 16, about 15 to 20% having a PGA of 0 or 1, or clear, almost clear skin. So this is a reasonable option for patients, again, who prefer oral treatments and have maybe less severe disease.
Well, thank you, Junko. And I think there's been so many advances here in psoriasis, and how off the press is there a new joint AAD-MPF guidelines for biologics in psoriasis? And I want to just go through a couple of what I viewed as clinical pearls that came out of these tables. They're sort of very lengthy guidelines to go through, but I think there's some things our listeners will find particularly useful. So one is a level A recommendation that etanercept is recommended as monotherapy in adults with moderate severe psoriasis affecting the scalp and nails, sort of a niche area of involvement. It's also for infliximab, it's recommended for infusing it more frequently or using doses up to 10 milligrams per kilogram. For adalimumab, recommending dosing as often as once a week for patients who require higher dosing. This type of guideline information should be really helpful to our clinicians because we often need to justify this to third-party payers. And I think this data that's emerged from clinical evidence is really helpful to help support what we need to do in clinical practice. Similar recommendations out there for, say, ustekinumab. Here, a level A recommendation about potentially using higher doses. So for people who are indicating to have the lower dose, but their weight is lower, we do recommend that you could use the 90 milligram dose or dose them every 8 weeks if they're not responding optimally to treatment. Secukinumab has been recommended as monotherapy in adult patients with moderate severe psoriasis affecting the nails or palmoplantar plaque psoriasis, a very important finding. Some patients just have bad scalp disease or just have bad nail disease. Traditionally, people may not have thought of using a biologic in those settings, but these people have high burden, and it's helpful to have a high efficacy treatment available for them. And then guselkumab, one of the more recently approved biologics, it's recommended as monotherapy treatment in adult patients with scalp, nail, or plaque-type palmoplantar psoriasis. So again, these are sort of off-label uses to some extent, not necessarily in the label from the FDA, but high levels of evidence showing they have a benefit in that circumstance. So Junko, so many treatments out there now. Help us go through this chart here that shows the various response rates for our different options.
Sure. So certainly it can be overwhelming trying to decide what to offer a patient who is naive to treatment. So I like this slide because it does put all, it shows in one graph here what the efficacy has been reported according to the PASI 90 response rate in clinical trials. Now, I do want to caution people looking at this that these are data coming from individual placebo-controlled trials, so they're not head-to-head comparisons, so take it with a grain of salt when you look at this data. But a couple of patterns that I want to point out. So if we look at the left, the three columns on the left, those are our oral agents, and our biologics are extending from there on to the right. And so in general, our biologics are more efficacious than our oral treatments. Now, if we concentrate on the biologics, we can see going generally from the older ones on the left to the newer ones on the right and more targeted, that we see increasing efficacy with the newer and more targeted therapies. Now, while some of our older treatments still work quite well, the newer ones really offer some new hope for some of our more difficult to treat patients. So I think this is a nice reference when you're trying to pick what treatment to offer to your patients.
I think when I talk to colleagues in other fields, rheumatoid arthritis or inflammatory bowel disease, they marvel at the response rates we could achieve. The idea of having a complex immune-mediated disease like psoriasis, be able to hit a specific target in there and have such high response rates is really remarkable. I find this information is often very helpful for counseling patients. I might say, well, if we try this IL-17 inhibitor, if I treated 10 patients, 8 or 9 will be pretty close to clear.
Yeah.
So they have a sense of what to expect from the response of the drug to go on. I want to show our faculty and our audience responses from our polling questions. So we went through the case, the young lady who had psoriasis affecting multiple areas of her body. When we asked about what people would recommend treatment-wise, 25% recommended topical therapy, 28 recommended methotrexate, 13 biologics, 6 a PDE4 inhibitor, 6 phototherapy, and 22 not sure. So let's have a discussion about this. I was a little surprised about some people recommending topicals. A patient had nail disease, I believe scalp disease, genital disease. Zhangmi, how would you approach such a patient?
excuse me. I believe a patient like this, I would definitely want to have a discussion about systemic therapy. When you have a BSA of greater than 12 and she's obese, you really do want to address the psoriasis as quickly as possible, especially since she may already have some psoriatic arthritis damage.
Yeah, I think realistically, when the body share is getting above 10%, topicals may be used as adjunctive treatment, but not the main treatment strategy. And then, you know, bad scalp disease, bad nail disease, that puts us in the direction of an oral or injectable medication, because light therapy won't work quite well there. Interesting, a lot of people chose methotrexate. Is a young woman, overweight, risk for liver disease. She's of childbearing potential. What's your thinking of the use of methotrexate junco in this patient population?
Yeah, I mean, I think you highlighted a lot of the considerations that actually might want to point me away from methotrexate in this young childbearing age woman who already has some risk factors for potentially having hepatotoxicity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it'd be my preference to actually steer away from methotrexate. I wonder if some of the responses are reflective of some of the step therapy requirements that are in place. And so, you know, because this person was relatively treatment naive, that maybe people were leaning towards methotrexate first. But yeah, I think we need to start stepping more towards biologics as first line.
Yeah, well, as people who spend a lot of time thinking about disease and educating about this disease, I think we should recognize that 22 responders said they did not know how they'd want to treat this patient. I think there's a lot of opportunity for educating people about these advances so they have a good sense of where they want to go with these type of patients. So Junko, you talked about a lot of the classic phase 3 clinical trial data out there. Tell us about how the drugs tend to perform under real-world circumstances.
Sure. So we know that, you know, the patients that we see in our clinic are not, you know, necessary clinical trial participants. And so there are differences in how well these treatments are working in real world as opposed to in the clinical trials. And we can see that very nicely on the graph on the left, which is a nice study that you did, Joel, looking at the comparative effectiveness of various treatments in psoriasis patients seen across various clinics in the U.S. And so in the vertical bars, we can see the percentage of people on each of these different treatments who reached an endpoint of clear or almost clear skin. And in contrast, the vertical bars at the top of the black bars, or sorry, the horizontal black bars at the top indicate the clearance rate as reported in randomized controlled trials. So you can see there's a difference here where the effectiveness is not as high as what's reported, the efficacy that's reported in clinical trials.
And this is true across a lot of diseases. We know rheumatoid arthritis, the response rates in clinical trials tend to be better than what they see in clinical practice. Tell us all about drug survival or drug persistence. What is this data showing us?
Sure. So this is a problem that we come across commonly in clinical practice, that patients initially have a response and lose response to their whatever therapy they're on, a biologic that they're on over time. And so a number of studies have been done in various biologic registries. This is the latest iteration coming out of a registry out of Denmark, looking at how long patients are on each biologic over time. And we can see here that ustekinumab is really the winner, with patients staying on ustekinumab the longest. Interestingly, secukinumab, which we talked about as being a fast actor and highly efficacious, a lot of people are actually coming off of that fairly quickly. Now, keep in mind, these are early data. This was done when secukinumab had not been on the market for very long. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with longer term and more data.
Yeah, and also a very small study for that group. So clearly we need more information to understand how IL-17s do long term in clinical practice in terms of persistence. So you know, we know these diseases have a lot of burden on people's health-related quality of life, a lot of stigma-related psoriasis. Oftentimes, the patients, go back and forth between periods of disease control and then flare. Xiangmi, tell us a little about your perspective on quality of life in patients with psoriasis, and a little bit what the data tells us about people's quality of life when they're coming off of treatment.
So, I tend to see patients who are doing very well. Their life has changed quite a bit. They're happier. A little more outgoing, they are able to wear clothing that maybe they weren't able to wear in the past. And when you see someone coming in with a flare, it almost seems as if they've reverted back to who they were prior to treatment, mm-hmm. and in some cases, even more so.
Yeah,
and
that's what these data sort of speak to, right? Which mm-hmm. is that this sort of graphic, if you will, these FDA-designed trials where they take the drug away from the patient to do intermittent therapy and see what happens. And you see for like the same PASI score, the quality of life impairment is twice as bad as it may be for a patient whose psoriasis is getting better as opposed to it getting worse. So I think for me as a clinician, I keep that in the back of my mind. I am really trying to avoid flares in patients. I'm trying to avoid withdrawing therapy whenever I can. Yeah, so Junko, one key to improving the quality of life of our patients is to make sure we and our patients are clear on what target or goal we're trying to reach. The treat-to-target approach is sort of new in the field of dermatology. How can it be used in psoriasis?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we've been talking about treat-to-target more these days in dermatology and in treatment of psoriatic disease. This is not a new concept. It's been around for a very long time in medicine. It has been used more commonly in cardiovascular medicine. I think we all know about blood pressure targets, glucose targets, in patients who have diabetes, for example. So the idea behind this is really that you identify some sort of clinically relevant target, for example, body surface area involvement for psoriasis, and you treat the disease until you reach that target. And the overall goal is really to improve patient outcomes. Now, we don't have a ton of data to really guide what that outcome should be and whether this actually improves outcomes for our patients. But what we do know is that if we look at the quality of life impact, having a stricter target actually has better impacts on our patients. Mm-hmm. So in a nice study that if I can say nice about our study, mm-hmm. that we did together, we saw that, you know, when we looked at the quality of life impact and compared them between patients who had clear versus almost clear skin, and we often think of almost clear skin to be a good objective outcome in terms of treatment, we saw that about 20% of patients who had almost clear skin had at least a moderate impact on their quality of life as measured by the DLQI, the Dermatology Life Quality Index.
Mm. That if people are only almost clear of their psoriasis, roughly 20% of them have high enough DLQI scores that you'd recommend changing the therapy. And this was a surprising finding when we did the study. I think most clinicians felt like, oh, well, if you're almost clear, that's good enough. Leave well enough alone, declare victory, move on. I think what this data is telling us clearly is that, in fact, many of our patients need to achieve better clearance to have full success in terms of their health-related quality of life. And so what I do in my practice is that when people are almost clear, I try and, but they're not completely clear, I try and understand how the disease is affecting them still. You know, are they still having a lot of symptoms that affect their well-being, affect their relationships, affect their work or their sleep? And for those who still have a lot of burden from the disease, we talk about trying to escalate therapy, either by adding on other therapies or switching therapies. So tell us a bit more about treat-to-target psoriasis. What type of targets have been proposed for our specialty?
So internationally, there have been all kinds of targets that have been proposed. But if we talk about something more local, the medical board of the National Psoriasis Foundation recently came out with some treatment target recommendations for plaque psoriasis, as shown here in this slide. Now, I do want to caution that these recommendations are based on expert opinion. So as I mentioned before, we don't have a ton of evidence at this time to really guide evidence-based targets. But the recommended, at least clinical measure of effectiveness was the body surface area involvement per expert agreement, that this was easy enough to incorporate into clinical practice. And the recommended treatment target was less than or equal to 1%, so that's a patient's full hand. This was recommended to be assessed 3 months after starting a treatment, and then every 6 months, aiming to maintain that 1% or less. Now, we realize that, you know, sometimes there are patients that we can't reach this target, and so there was a softer target that was also suggested, an acceptable treatment target at 3 months after initiation of a BSA of less than or equal to 3%, or at least a 75% improvement in the BSA. Now, we actually have some measures in place that encourage us to think about and take part in this treat-to-target approach. And shown here is a formerly PQRS, now incorporated into the MIPS system, our pay-for-performance system, our only dermatology outcome performance measure. It's called the Clinical Response to Oral Systemic or Biologic Medications. And this is relevant for our patients who are on systemic treatment for at least 6 months. And the outcome targets that have been recommended are a PGA of less than or equal to 2, or a BSA of less than 3%, or a PASI of less than 3, or a DLQI of less than or equal to 5. If you meet any of one of these, you meet the performance for this measure. So how are we doing? So according to 2015, at the time it was called PQRS, our reporting data, we had just under 1,300 individuals reporting for this measure, and about a 70% performance rate who met one of these targets. So we're doing reasonably well, but there's certainly some room for improvement.
Yeah, I think that these are pretty exciting data, and it's important, I think, for people in the dermatology space to recognize that this is really our only outcome-based measure to demonstrate the quality of care we give in dermatology and something to really take advantage of. And it's an opportunity to sort of measure ourselves over time and see if we can't get better. As most clinicians, we want to continue to improve the outcomes for our patients. I think it's very helpful. Jagmeet, you have a very busy practice as a PA. Tell us a little bit what your perspective is in the real world in clinical practice, trying to get people clear, things of that nature.
Well, we have multiple types of patients. I'll have a patient that may come in who may have a BSA of 15, but they're not that concerned about the plaques that can be hidden by their clothing and maybe just the visible plaques. And there are other patients who may have a much smaller BSA, and their main concern is to be completely clear. So it's important to have a conversation with your patient in order to determine what your goals are along with the patient's goals.
Yeah, I think that's so important, the idea of having to be shared decision-making, having a therapeutic alliance with the patient of what we're trying to achieve together. That really helps improve adherence, improve patient satisfaction. So, and you know, our ultimate goal, I think, would be to try and have 100% clearance, because we know from some of the data Junko has shown and other data out there that when people are clear, they have better responses in their health-related quality of life. But are we doing a good job talking to our patients regarding the goal of treatment? Let's listen to some patient responses when they're asked if they believe dermatologists are aligning treatment strategies with the long-term goal of total plaque clearance.
I would say that the treatment has been very successful. I know that new techniques are being used that have been more effective than the techniques in the past.
Yes. So, Junko, would you agree with what the patients had to say? What is your experience with achieving complete skin clearance in practice? What type of tips can you give for helping us achieve better in this area?
Yeah, I mean, I think with all of the treatment options we have currently, it's actually a reality for some of our patients. But, you know, as we looked at the data, certainly not all of our patients, so I like to set realistic expectations that, you know, for some people, you know, we can potentially achieve clear skin for you, but at the very least, you know, I think I can get you to almost clear skin. Mm-hmm. And I will say most patients are pretty happy with that, and I think it's, you know, setting realistic expectations on both parts is really important.
You know, so many factors go into how we're going to choose the right treatment for the right patient at the right time, efficacy being one,
sure.
Other factors go into play. Jiangmi, how do you navigate this complex decision-making with your patients? What are the factors you take in mind to arrive at the right call?
It can be a bit challenging because you have to take into consideration the patient's comorbidities, even the cost of medication and whether or not it's something that is attainable, something they can get due to insurance. I would say now there are so many choices as, you know, 10 years ago we didn't have these choices. It's great to have a good conversation and educate your patient on what's available so you can decide. But for the most part, I look for efficacy, safety, and determine the patient's comorbidities.
Yeah. Junko, what's your perspective on this topic? How do you decide what therapy you're going to use first?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on a lot of things, as Jiangmi was suggesting. And so I have, you know, similar sorts of conversations and considerations. Comorbidities and whether or not they have psoriatic arthritis certainly plays an important role with therapy choice. Patients' preferences, for example, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, some people are willing to inject themselves with needles, with the biologics, and other patients are really needle phobic and prefer orals. So, you know, a lot of factors and really requires an in-depth conversation with the patient.
Well, you mentioned psoriatic arthritis as being a differentiating factor. It's a good prelude into our next segment, our next learning objective, which is to ensure management of comorbid conditions in patients with psoriasis through screening and appropriate referral when necessary. So first, let's engage our clinicians watching our program again. You should see the question on your screen. How often do you check blood pressure in patients with psoriasis? Now, answer honestly. Tell us what you actually do in clinical practice. The options are A, never, B, sometimes, C, frequently, D, always. Please give us your honest answers now, and we will review those responses shortly. All right, so psoriasis is associated with a variety of comorbidities. Junko Zhangmi, which ones do you most commonly encounter in clinical practice and commonly screen for and discuss with your patients? Why don't I start with Zhangmi? What's the first one that comes to your top of your head?
The first one in my patient population is metabolic syndrome. Mm-hmm. I have so many patients who are in the obese category who may be insulin resistant. And if we are starting them on a biologic, we kind of do screening for those conditions.
Yeah, sure. And of course, that metabolic syndrome complicates safety of some therapies. They may be more at risk of fatty liver disease, for example, making methotrexate use more difficult. Junko, your perspective, what's the top one that comes to your mind when it comes to comorbidities?
Yeah, so similarly, I see metabolic syndrome or one of its components most commonly. And in terms of screening, you know, we get a blood pressure and we have a weight on all of our patients coming into clinic. So that's a nice opportunity to intervene, especially if patients, younger patients, don't have primary care providers. Mm-hmm. Of course, psoriatic arthritis is a common comorbidity that we encounter in our psoriasis patients and always asking about joint pain at every visit.
Yeah, I think the one way to think about comorbid diseases and psoriasis is a sort of holistic approach to patient care that patients are really looking for. And when they come to see us either as their PA or their physician, their dermatologist, they view us as the one who's the captain of their healthcare ship, especially the younger folks who might be in their 20s, 30s, or 40s, sometimes even their 50s. They may not have a primary care doctor providing them with any information about things. So we know there are a number of potential comorbidities in our patients with psoriasis, and we need to discuss these issues with patients, but do we? Let's now hear how patients responded when asked if they thought dermatologists typically discuss comorbidities with them.
I would say, based on conversations in my community, dermatologists do not discuss comorbidities with psoriasis. I find that new people to the group will ask a question about their psoriasis and will be surprised at the answer from a group member and will say, wow, my doctor never told me that, or I didn't know that, or the doctor didn't share that with me.
It's been my experience that dermatologists typically want to just treat the skin and don't really discuss any other kinds of treatment.
Well, I think this is really provocative information from these two patients, probably pretty representative, actually. How do we do better, Junko?
Well, I think continuing to have educational events like this, increasing the educational reach, both on the patient end as well as provider end, are really, really important. I think that's the most important thing to do.
Yeah, so I want to spend a little time talking about psoriasis and the risk of cardiometabolic disease. And the reason why we want to focus on this is because it's really one of the main causes of morbidity and mortality in people in general, but in people with psoriasis in particular. And we know from the last, say, 15 years of research that people with psoriasis, especially when it's moderate to severe, meaning they require systemic agents or phototherapy, or they have it on more than 10% of the body surface area, that they're more likely to develop major cardiovascular events, independent of traditional risk factors, and they die about 5 years younger than they should based on their other health problems they have. And why this occurs, we're not 100% certain, but we believe that the type of inflammation seen in psoriasis is the same type of inflammation that drives metabolic abnormalities and drives atherosclerosis and cardiovascular events that is similar between these phenotypically distinct diseases. And sort of thinking about treatment of psoriasis, you know, the logical hypothesis would be that, well, if someone has bad psoriasis and I treat it, would that lower their risk of having cardiovascular events or mortality over time? And some data is emerging in this area. First, some observational data, this meta-analysis of four studies here, showing that patients with psoriasis who got TNF inhibitors compared to patients with psoriasis who got other therapies, that they had roughly a 30% reduction in their odds of developing a myocardial infarction. Now, this is kind of promising data in some ways, showing a risk reduction in a major health comorbidity, but it is observational data. It doesn't always have the type of control for other factors you'd like to have. For example, in these studies, they didn't control for, say, body weight or whether or not the patient was overall healthy or not so healthy, but certainly taking us in the right direction of where we'd like to see the data go. Zhangmi, when you are thinking about treatment decisions for your patients, how much does the impact of our treatments on cardiovascular risk play a role in your thinking right now?
I honestly feel that we should be treating psoriasis aggressively regardless of its impact on cardiovascular health, but it'll be interesting to see what kinds of new data come out.
Yeah, and what about you, Junko? What's your opinion on how we should factor in the emerging data of psoriasis therapies of modulating cardiovascular risk at this point in time?
Yeah, I agree with you. The observational data are interesting, but because of, you know, the limitations of observational data that you touched upon, you know, I think we're not there yet. So I personally don't use cardiovascular disease as an endpoint or an end game when I discuss treatment with my patients, and like Zhang-Mi, really focus on the skin or the joints.
Well, certainly this is an area of active investigation. This area is moving very rapidly. It's of keen interest not only to dermatologists and their patients, of course, but all people in cardiology community, internal medicine community, where increasing drugs are being developed to target inflammation as a way of lowering cardiovascular disease risk. And psoriasis may ultimately lead the way. We may discover that, in fact, our drugs do causally lower risk of cardiovascular disease. You know, my program has been involved over the last 6 years or so doing a series of randomized controlled placebo studies looking at the impact of our therapies on measures of aortic vascular inflammation, a marker of cardiovascular risk, and other blood-based markers of cardiovascular disease. And showing this slide here to our audience, a recent publication of our group in the cardiology literature looking at adalimumab and phototherapy compared to placebo. And interestingly, you know, we thought adalimumab would improve aortic vascular inflammation. It actually didn't change it in our study. We found over 12 weeks of treatment that adalimumab really had no effect on cholesterol performance or metabolism or glucose metabolism, but it actually dramatically improved markers of inflammation, CRP, TNF-alpha, glyca, and most importantly, IL-6. And IL-6 is felt to be causally related to cardiovascular disease based on a variety of other lines of evidence. So that's a very promising finding in terms of immunomodulation. And then over 12 weeks, actually, phototherapy had some improvements as well. It improved HDLP, so it made good cholesterol even better. It had a neutral effect on glucose metabolism, and it actually improved inflammation. We think of phototherapy having localized effects, but it actually lowered CRP and lowered interleukin-6, which is pretty provocative finding. Now, over longer-term treatment, over about a year, people continued on adalimumab in the study, and the results were a little bit mixed. There were some mild impairments in how well HDL functioned. Inflammation generally remained well-controlled, although actually IL-6 tended to go up a little bit. And so this is a reminder of the importance of understanding the mechanism of how drugs work, but also ultimately having, you know, large-scale, endpoint-driven studies to definitively understand what's going on. Moving around this theme, more work is being done with other cardiovascular markers, something called flow-mediated dilation, an early marker of cardiovascular disease, if you will. And there was a recent study of secukinumab compared to placebo looking at its effects on FMD. And these investigators first showed that people with psoriasis, they have impaired flow-mediated dilation at baseline, much more so than people who don't have psoriasis. Compared to placebo at week 12, there wasn't a change in FMD. At week 52, compared to the baseline, those who got the higher dose of secukinumab, the labeled dose of 300 milligrams, they actually had an improvement in their FMD at week 52 compared to baseline. So we're seeing some emerging data out there with hints that our therapies could affect cardiovascular pathways in positive ways. I do want to take a moment now to again mention the new joint AAD-MPF guidelines. These just came out yesterday. They're in press on the AAD website. They'll be published soon, but they're available for readers to look at. And there's a special guideline on psoriasis and cardiovascular and comorbidities. And here what they're recommending is educating patients about these risks of cardiovascular disease and making sure they're up to date on age-appropriate screenings for cardiovascular risk factors, be it blood pressure or diabetes, lipids. For those with more severe disease, those are people you want to target for more aggressive control of traditional cardiovascular risk factors. So those who have body surface area 10 or more percent on their body, or those who require oral or systemic therapies, these are people that their primary doctor should know should be thinking about managing their lipids a little more aggressively than based on standard previous ways of thinking. And these guidelines continue to emerge. We should have a listing for our members at home, a slide that shows what are the standard timelines of checking blood pressure in patients, screens for diabetes, and doing cardiovascular risk assessment. The cardiovascular risk assessment will also often be done by their primary care doctor, usually at age 40 to 79. We're going to figure out their 10-year risk of an event and then determine if they should be on a statin based on that in terms of managing their lipids. It's easy to screen for diabetes. In my practice, I do a hemoglobin A1C. They don't have to be fasting for it. And speaking more about guidelines, I'll notice that recently the AHA, American Heart Association, and ACC guidelines came out for updating people about how to manage cardiovascular risk related to cholesterol management. And of special interest is they called out people with psoriasis for requiring more aggressive management of their lipids. So the first time that a non-dermatologic organization now engaging in this area of comorbidities, recognizing that patients who may be on the border of needing a statin, that they have psoriasis, or they have metabolic syndrome, or they have arthritis. Sounds like a lot of our patients, that we probably should be encouraging the patient to use a statin in those circumstances. So let's look at our audience response question we asked. We asked providers how often they check blood pressure in their patients with psoriasis. And it looks like 8% say never, 32% say sometimes, 42% say frequently, 18% say always. Well, I think it shows that we have some opportunities for improvement in this area. Let's hear what patients have to say when asked if they believe their dermatologist screen for these comorbidities.
Often, dermatologists do not counsel their patients about cardiovascular health and psoriatic arthritis. However, there is becoming more of a push, and patients are becoming more aware on their own and talking to their doctors, their dermatologists about this, about these two conditions. And then the dermatologist typically will go further at that point. However, not very often will the dermatologist bring up these issues on their own.
I personally have not been screened for this at all. I didn't even know that psoriasis was related to cardiovascular health in any way.
Well, I think this is really ear-opening, eye-opening statements from our patients. These are fairly motivated people who are getting good care. What can we do to improve things? I think certainly in my practice, talking to patients about these comorbidities, they tend to really appreciate that information because they want to know what's going to happen to their overall health, how psoriasis plays a role in it. Certainly a more holistic way to discuss these issues with our patients. Certainly a place to start is screening for cardiovascular risk factors. That is the one way to try and lower the risk of mortality over time in patients. And we think about cardiovascular risk starting early on in life. So even young people, kids with pediatric psoriasis tend to have more metabolic syndrome, for example. So it's never too soon to start educating about these issues, talking about healthy lifestyle, healthy weights, things of that nature. Of course, classically, we as dermatologists who take care of these patients, we think of psoriatic arthritis as being one of the main comorbidities we need to be alert for. Jingmei, tell me a little bit how you think about psoriatic arthritis, how you screen for it.
When I see a new patient with psoriasis, I prefer them in a gown so I can examine their whole body, including their joints. And I do palpate and I ask questions about joint pain and whether or not it's worsening over the day or if it's mostly in the morning. And I believe that kind of helps me separate out patients who have active disease in psoriatic arthritis or do they just have plaque. And that helps me also decide the types of treatment I would provide.
Yeah, I think these are really good pearls. Because I think joint pains will be common in people with psoriasis. Our job is to try and figure out, is this inflammatory in nature? As you mentioned, that they wake up, they feel stiff, and it gets better with activity, as opposed to, say, osteoarthritis, where it feels better at rest and worse when they're more active, things of that nature. Certainly changes the way we're going to think about what treatment we're going to give. Junko, what your perspective on screening for psoriatic arthritis? Any pearls you may have?
Yeah, I mean, I have similar sort of approach to Jungmi's approach. And I think also important to remember that you really need to be asking about joint pain and examining the joints at every visit when you're seeing the patient, because psoriatic arthritis could show up at any point. There are also some tools to help with psoriatic arthritis screening and diagnosis, but I don't necessarily think you have to use those and simply asking the questions about joint pain and the nature of the joint pain is important.
Well, it's a complicated topic. Hopefully our audience members will ask some questions, give us opportunity to talk more about, delve into more detail later on. You know, we often talk about risks of other comorbidities like malignancy or cancer in people with psoriasis, especially because a lot of them are smokers or overweight. Obviously, there's often a concern about the immunomodulatory therapies could potentially have risks related to cancer. What are some of the regular age-appropriate cancer screenings we should be recommending to our patients that would be standard for anyone?
Yeah, so it's nicely summarized in this slide. When I see my more severe psoriasis patients and those who are on immunosuppressive therapy, I ask them about all of their age-appropriate screening, cancer screening, so breast cancer, cervical cancer for women, colorectal cancer, and lung cancer screening, which is a little bit of a newer screening recommendation. So these are really important to ask your patients.
Yeah, so in my own practice, I've picked up two or three lung cancers in my career already by using new guidelines about low-dose CTs for people who are heavy smokers. And I think it's a real opportunity to use these techniques for early detection. Let's talk about other comorbidities, including the clinical implications of the association of psoriasis with infection. And this has been a little bit less studied, surprisingly. But basically, we know that that infection is the second leading cause of mortality in people with psoriasis. We know that streptococcal disease could cause guttate flares, and so we need to screen for that when people present that way. We know that HIV can be something that drives severe psoriasis in patients, so those who present with really inflammatory disease, we want to think about HIV disease. And then being part of a broader care team, we want to think about, you know, the vaccination strategies available to our patients. In our own practice, we immunize people regularly with the flu shot every year. We know a lot of our patients are on immune modulating therapies. We have to say, oh, if you get sick, you should hold off on treatment or delay your treatment. Well, we try and do what we can to try to lower the risk of infection over time. You know, Junko, a multidisciplinary approach to the management of psoriasis is critical. It's such a complicated disease. The patients have a lot going on. What type of people do you tend to collaborate with on the care of your patients? What kind of specialists?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I definitely like to keep the primary care physician, if the patient has one, involved. And if they don't have one, encourage them to get one. With psoriatic arthritis being such a common comorbidity that we see, being in close contact and collaboration with a rheumatologist is really key and can be very helpful for combined management. I think some other key people to be involved in are cardiologists, even just for routine screening baseline screening or management of existing cardiovascular disease already, as well as people who are overweight, hooking them up with people who can help and counsel, make weight or nutrition recommendations, and then a psychologist or psychiatrist for anybody who has mood symptoms.
Yeah. So that's, you know, one part of the coin is who we as the providers of taking care of someone's psoriasis, what other specialists we should think about. Zhangmi, from your perspective, when should the primary care doctor be thinking about getting us involved in the care of someone's psoriasis?
I would say as soon as a patient presents with psoriasis, I don't believe a primary care should be trying to treat psoriasis because it's such a wide range of inflammatory issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is pretty hard for a general practitioner or a primary care doctor to keep up with all these advances that are going on in psoriasis. Certainly, I guess the way I would think about it is that, you know, one, if you have any question about the diagnosis whatsoever, I think you'd want to refer them to a dermatologist, a PA who specializes in the area, because there's always a differential diagnosis beyond psoriasis, whether it be a skin cancer presenting that way or an infection presenting that way. So I guess I would say, yeah, if you're not certain of the diagnosis or if you don't try a simple treatment and it doesn't work well for them, then it probably would be helpful to have a specialist involved in the care, as someone has a sort of lifelong chronic disease that could cause so much stigma and suffering. Yeah, so let's see how our patients responded when asked if their dermatologist typically coordinate with other specialists.
I hate to say it, but my dermatologist has never, ever tried to hook me up with a psychiatrist, a counselor, endocrinologist, or rheumatologist in reference to my psoriasis. These are subjects that he has never brought up to me. I'm trying to think if I ever brought them up to him, because when I first was diagnosed with psoriasis and I had it very, very badly, it was a horrible experience for me, and I probably did need to go to a counselor, but it was never given to me as an option.
Yeah, so I think this patient sort of alluding to the fact that this disease could be very overwhelming to have and very burdensome, very stigmatizing, and we need to be thinking about, you know, how we could better integrate their care with other providers. Zhangmi, do you have any top tips of how to be successful in this area?
Well, I truly believe nurse practitioners and PAs can play a role in optimizing the care for patients with psoriasis, especially because of the way that we're trained. Nurse practitioners are trained in the nursing model, which is very patient-centered, and physician assistants are trained based in primary care. So our basis of medicine is in primary care. So we are looking at all of these different comorbidities, and we're looking to develop relationships with other specialties that are going to help our patient have a more well-rounded treatment.
Yeah, personally, I really enjoy collaborating with PAs and NPs in the care of people with psoriasis. One is that they're often better trained in primary care than not we are as clinical dermatologists sometimes, and so it's helpful to know that they are a little more up to date on some of those things. And I agree, I think the holistic view of the patients is so important. The patients respond to that quite a bit. So let's move on now to our final learning objective, which is to integrate digital coaching into the management of patients with psoriasis to improve patient outcomes and treatment satisfaction. Zhangmi, can you tell us a little bit about digital health tools that can be useful for patients with psoriasis?
Yes. So there are multiple digital health tools, not just for psoriasis, but in psoriasis in general. The National Psoriasis Foundation has a wonderful support system through their online program. Mm-hmm. There is also a pocket guide for practitioners to help them manage the options for treatment for their patients, and as well as a way to analyze data based on a survey that patients take anonymously.
Yeah, I think these tools that the National Psoriasis Foundation offers are really valuable to patients. You know, it's so overwhelming to get all this information from us in the office. Having another place they can go to for a trusted source of information is helpful. And of course, I don't want to say to the patient, just go look this up on the internet. I could say, you know, go to the National Psoriasis Foundation website. They have these tools available to you, and I know they'll get the right information they need. Increasingly, developers are creating apps for the cell phone. Everyone's on their cell phone 24/7 these days. Tell us a little about, you know, what kind of apps are available for people with psoriatic disease?
There are so many new things coming out, and it's a very exciting time to have psoriasis, I guess. There are applications that help you manage your psoriasis and the psoriatic arthritis. There are some apps that help you remember to take your medication, because there are so many people who, if they're on methotrexate, they only take it once a week. What if they forget that week? Also, as we've been talking about comorbidities, there's an app that kind of helps a patient track their health and staying healthy and getting physical. And then also, when we're dealing with the anxiety and depression of people with psoriasis, there are ways that people can now track their feelings.
Yeah, you know, all these tools are available on the CME Outfitters website as a way of looking at them. I think they're super valuable. You know, as clinicians, we forget the fact that we only spend a teeny tiny fraction of the patient's life with us in our office, right? Then they're out in the real world trying to manage their disease with very little support. I think these are great things to offer our patients so they have, you know, a place to go to that keeps them engaged with their treatment plans, helps keep them on target, helps them adhere to therapies, things of that nature. Another thing we have available now is the PAC Health Toolkit, a digital health coaching program available through the CME Outfitters website. Tell us a little bit about what this program's about.
So this is a 12-week program that helps our patients coach through the beginning of their psoriasis treatment. And as that other patient had said, that she was a little upset that her dermatologist didn't refer her to a psychiatrist or a counselor or an endocrinologist. Well, the lovely thing about this program is this will help our patients go to the right types of providers. So if a patient doesn't have a primary care, it'll help guide them towards a primary care physician, as well as a coach who will call and they can speak with them weekly or get text messages so they don't feel like they're the only ones out there with the disease.
I think this can be so helpful for our patients. You know, my patients tell me all the time, I always ask, well, when did you take your last shot of your biologic? they look at their feet for a while. You know, and so I think it'd be really valuable if people have an extra set of tools to remind them when they're due for something. You know, these tools have been studied in the real world setting, 30 patients who've been using them. Tell us a little bit about what we learned about the benefits of the tools from this observational study.
So it's a small number of people, but they have been able to prove that patients have improved their health and their mental health by being a part of this 12-week program. And also in the confidence of managing their psoriasis. So, you know, we spoke on psoriasis being such an overwhelming condition, and there's a lot of information that's given to a patient in the beginning. So, of course, you know, if you're someone who is not in the medical field, it can be very overwhelming, and you can feel very, very scared with your treatment. But
yeah, I think that's one of the most striking finds of that study, which is, you know, over 50% of patients felt more confident to manage their disease versus 11% pre. It's a really big benefit. Just thinking quickly, you know, who's the ideal patient in your practice that you would think about using a digital health tool with?
Definitely any new patient diagnosed with psoriasis. There's also our patients who are long-term who may need to further on their step for therapy, maybe going on to systemic therapy, or patients with multiple comorbidities, someone who doesn't have a primary care because, you know, a lot of patients try to manage their own health mm-hmm. by going to the specialists that they feel that they need to see.
Yeah, and I find that virtually all my patients in clinical practice now have a smartphone. They're usually on it when I walk in the room, and it's a great way to engage them and say, you know, these tools are available. You can print them on your phone and help you achieve better confidence in your care plan, better outcomes over time. So, you know, I think we covered a lot today. I think today's discussion was extremely useful. Junko, what are the three key takeaways that clinicians should be doing differently in their clinical practice based on today's program, the 100th program of CME Outfitters?
So I think first and foremost, we need to continue to engage our patients in decisions about their care for their psoriasis and potentially their psoriatic arthritis and make sure that we're incorporating their preferences into treatment selection. We heard a lot about comorbidities and how patients haven't either been educated about comorbidities or not screened, so certainly discussing and screening for comorbidities. And then third point is really to consider the treat-to-target approach and at least talk about treatment goals with your patients and make sure that you're approaching those goals each time.
Yeah, and I'd be remiss to say that today is Valentine's Day, by the way. And so, Zhangmi, which of the three learning points do you love the most from this program?
Well, I love the fact that we are stressing a multidisciplinary team to optimize our patient's treatment, and that you are including physician assistants and nurse practitioners because we can help manage and optimize their treatment. We build strong relationships with our patients. And, of course, these digital health tools are just amazing that are out there available.
Well, thank you both for a very good program that focused on improving the care of our patients. I want to remind our audience that we've created a very useful downloadable resource that includes the slides we presented today, as well as references and tools. I encourage you to please visit www.cmeoutfitters.com for a comprehensive list of clinical resources, outcomes research, news, additional educational activities for both providers and patients, and a whole lot more. Well, we have a lot of great questions coming in from our audience members who are watching, listening in at home or at work, and we'll try and get through as many as we can. So the first one I really liked says, can you talk about the presentation of psoriasis in different ethnicities and skin colors? Let me ask Zhangmi to take a first stab at that one. Tell us a little bit how you manage psoriasis in people of color.
Well, people of color do tend to present slightly differently. Instead of the red, thickened, scaly plaques that you may see on someone who is of Anglo descent, someone, say, who is African American may just have very lichenified skin and it may present as dry and itchy and or painful. Treatment also, you know, we discussed a lot of the cosmetics of treatment. Mm-hmm. Once the plaques are clear in an African American or even Asian or Hispanic person, there's still this post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, which can still seem to be unseemly for those patients.
How do you tell people to deal with post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation, what to expect, how long it will be there for?
So I tend to start from the beginning when I discuss their disease state with them and, and talk about their treatment outcomes and what our goals are. I warn them that there will probably be some hyperpigmentation, and the amount of time that it takes to fade differs in every person. I encourage them to wear sunscreen. A lot of people of color don't get that education.
Yeah, well, it's certainly an added burden that people of color face with psoriasis, something I'm pretty sensitive to. I try to be a little more aggressive trying to control their skin disease, especially if they demonstrate a lot of post-inflammatory changes. These are people I particularly worry about losing response to therapies or having intermittent treatments. You know, I try and explain, well, if your disease comes back, you know, we may be dealing with, you know, another couple of years of waiting for the skin color to come back to your normal pigment. So, Junko, I know you're a leading expert in doing research in this area. You've done some qualitative research trying to understand how people with different racial backgrounds, ethnicities, think about psoriasis and treatments. What have we learned from the work that you've done?
Yeah, so in first looking at quality of life impact, there's some data out there, it's not my work, but work that has been done by Andrew Lexis that has shown that minority groups tend to have a worse quality of life impact due to their psoriasis, irrespective of disease severity compared to white individuals. So there may be a larger quality of life impact in patients of darker skin or of minority races or ethnicities. I think it's very important to think about the post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation and some of the qualitative work that we've done. Certainly, when comparing white versus black patients and their concerns about psoriasis, there's definitely more concern about what is often referred to as scarring. So providing education that, you know, most of the time it's not permanent and they're not scars, I think, is key.
I think it's a really critical point. You know, I think as physicians, caregivers, one of our first responsibilities is to educate the patient, right?
Sure.
And so when people think of it as a scar, obviously it's going to create a lot more concern. If we can say, this is not permanent, this will go away, that could just take a very long period of time. I think it's a really important point. Another question out there is about quality measures used in clinical practice as opposed to clinical trials. You know, most of us don't do POSIs in clinical practice or done in trials. Junko, what are some of the measures that you collect on your patients to help you think about their care over time?
So I typically collect a body surface or measure a body surface area and then also do a physician global assessment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a nice sort of combination of how much area-wise the body is involved and then incorporates the quality of the plaques in the PGA. They're very quick to do. And somehow people in Europe are able to do POSIs. But yeah, absolutely, that's not practical for clinical practice.
Yeah, well, for the highly motivated person, at least we know that a POSI, a PGA score multiplied by a BSA pretty much captures
sure,
what POSI
yeah.
does. I find it very useful to do a BSA and a PGA in all my patients because, you know, I know these patients for years, and it's helpful when making treatment decisions over time to go back and say, oh, when I first met you, you had 25% of your body involved with really thick plaques. And here we are today, now you have 2% and what have you. And my patients often really appreciate that because it's hard to remember how things were before we went on this journey together. The other thing I do is I have my medical assistant ask two simple questions to the patients. We first ask them, you know, think about the physical symptoms of your psoriasis, how much it itches or flakes or burns, how bad is it to you? 10 being the worst, 0 not at all. And then think about the emotional aspect of this disease. You know, how much stress or anxiety or worries of causing or is affecting your relationships, 10 being the worst, 0 being doesn't bother you at all. These things are very helpful for me as a clinician, because when I walk in a room and their BSA is 3% and their PGA is 2, but their subjective scores are really bad, I'm already leaning towards using more aggressive therapies for these patients. So we talked a little about how some therapies may lose response over time. This seems to be true of all of the therapies we have available, especially the biologics. They may lose response at different rates. Think about secukinumab. Zhang Mi, if you have a patient who's done really well on secukinumab but maybe losing some response after they've gone through the induction phase, how do you handle that? Do you think about adding an oral medication, or how do you manage that in practice?
Normally in our practice, we will add in some UV therapy along with their biologic. We also have a discussion about changing biologics.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few patients who fail an IL-17 but do very well on an IL-23.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's so helpful to have a clear record of what they've been on in the past and what their responses has been, right? So a patient who, say, was a primary failure of a TNF inhibitor, I probably wouldn't use another TNF inhibitor in that patient. And if their insurance company told me I had to, I'd say, listen, this person already failed one. They're unlikely to respond to another one. We should move on to a different mechanism of action. That can be very helpful for understanding where we go with these patients. This is another good question. If a patient is 90% clear and they want to stop therapy, do you stop the biologic? So Junko, tell us your perspective on that one.
So this is actually not an uncommon question that comes up from patients, is how long, if I'm doing well now, how long do I have to stay on the biologic? So my general discussion with a patient is that, A, we know that psoriasis is a chronic disease, so if we go off therapy, it's much more likely than not that your psoriasis is going to come back. So that's one reason that I don't generally recommend coming off the biologic. The other thing is that we know that with biologics, with increasing number of interruptions, that going back on that specific biologic again, you're less likely to have as good of a response as you initially did. Mm. So barring any side effects or loss of response, I try to encourage patients to stay on the biologic, but certainly if the patient has a strong preference to come off, I won't force them to stay on treatment.
Jiang-Mei, what's your perspective on this?
I feel the same way as Dr. Takesh.
Yeah. I mean, I have a similar approach. And usually, the first question a patient always has is, how long do I have to be on this medication, doc? And usually that's when we're starting it. And I say, you know what, I like to have all my patients on the drug for at least a year. Because I say, we really want to get a sense of what's out to control your disease, hopefully have your psoriasis well controlled for a good year of time. Then we should reassess and see how we think about things and what our options are. And then I counsel people, try and give them an anchor, if you will, because in my experience, the overwhelming majority of patients elect to stay on therapy. It's pretty rare for me in my practice for someone to say, my skin's been clear for a year, I want to go back to having psoriasis, can I stop this? That's actually pretty uncommon for me. But at least they know that we're going to have a chance to discuss this again in the future. And then when we get to that point, I do bring up to the issue that, we don't know for sure if they have to stay on the drug. I mean, we know it's an incurable disease, and for most people, disease will come back eventually when we stop their biologic. I'm struck by having been in practice for a good period of time now that some of my patients who stopped their biologic for a variety of reasons, insurance reasons, or they moved or something like that, and their psoriasis hasn't come back for years. So I think we have to be humble as prescribers, recognize we can't really guarantee the future for people. And I am supportive too. I say, if you want to take a holiday off the drug, we could certainly do that, or we could try increasing the interval. And if you see any signs of psoriasis coming back, we know that you're the kind of patient who needs to stay on the drug. But if you're spreading it out to every 6 weeks, every 8 weeks, or whatever, and you still have no signs, and we stop, and you have no signs, and you have a stressful week at work, and you get sick, and it's not coming back, well, maybe we can watch things and see how they do. Yeah. Right, yeah. So this is a great question about how do you use systemic therapies as a first option when an insurance company will require proof of failure of less costly methods of treatment, such as topicals? This always makes me crazy. When I get a response back from an insurer, the patient needs to fail Anthrolyn cream. And I'm like, Anthrolyn cream? Like,
I haven't gotten that one yet.
I get that all the time. Either. Yes. Yes, some of our payers. Now, of course, it's variable around the country what your payers will come up with. Or maybe they're more creative with me. I made a lot of friends in the insurance industry. Junko, how do you handle the situation?
So I actually try to fight it as best I can. I talk about the evidence that we have to show how effective certain therapies are. Mm-hmm. The patient has severe disease and needs a systemic treatment and their quality of life impact, and appeal to them to the insurance company that you're going to be responsible for any additional medical care that this patient is going to require because of any potential complications and such.
Yeah, so I think invariably most patients by the time they've gotten to us, they've been on at least one topical. It's usually par for the course. But I think the new AAD-MPF guidelines, of course, could be helpful, explaining that who we feel are candidates for systemic agents, you know, that you know your topical is not going to help with nail disease, for example, or they have tough genital disease. It's really, you know, they can try, but they often will fail it. And I find in my experience that writing a letter to the insurance company saying that, you know, one, this is the reason why I want to do it, this is the objective severity of the patient's disease or the impairment they're having in their well-being or work or what have you, and this is, in my medical opinion, what needs to happen. Most of the times, I find I'm pretty successful in that circumstance. But I do feel like we as providers and prescribers have to prepare our patients for this battle, you know, because there's nothing more deflating than coming in, hearing from us about all these great options, and then next thing you know, it's 4 months later, and they're still trying to get something approved. So they have to know that it's going to be a process. We're going to be working with them through this process. I'll say we talked a lot about multiple care teams here. You know, we're lucky. We have pharmacists in our system. We're in a big practice. Do you have a pharmacist that you get to collaborate with?
No.
Yeah. So I'll say this is something that, you know, for us, so I could see Jacqueline is wincing and Joker and I are smiling.
Yeah.
Because I tell you, when we had a pharmacist embedded in our practice, that dramatically improved the quality of my life.
As well as our patients' lives.
Oh, certainly,
most
our patients. Most important, our patients. But yeah. because the far, you know, our pharmacists are just, you know, that's their area of expertise. They know how to get access for the patients, and then they are an added layer of education. You know, they've heard from me about the drug, its risks and benefits, how to use it. But then our pharmacist is going to go through that with them again. All right, so I like this question. When I was in training, I was told not to put a patient on a biologic. These drugs were too potent and many risks and side effects. So we'll ask for some reactions to that. Zhang Mi, you want to give us your first reaction to that?
It's funny because I was just mentioning last night that when I first started in my practice, I was told that I should not prescribe Enbrel to a patient with psoriasis. So, I mean, this was a good 10, 11 years ago. So it's just, it's interesting to see the way that science is moving. You know, there's safety data out there now. I don't see any reason why one wouldn't start a patient on a biologic at this point.
Yeah, I think that there's often some biologic phobia that goes on out there. And I think that, again, as physicians, we have to be humble. You know, rare, unusual things could happen with any medication, of course. I think that the earlier experience of biologics, certainly some of the T-cell-driven therapies were much more spotty in their safety records. One drug, ifalizumab, got pulled from the market because of a signal-related progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, affect about 4 or 5 people. And another drug called elefisept, it really wasn't that effective and people weren't using it. You know, the TNF inhibitors have very long-term safety data in our meta-analysis where they're used as a monotherapy, not like an RA or IBD where they're getting prednisone, other immune-modifying therapies like azathioprine. You know, their rates of infection and malignancy are basically the same as placebo. If not, their rates of infection are a little bit lower, actually, in a meta-analysis we've done. Likely because they're not scratching into skin and having as much of a portal of entry. So certainly these are drugs we have to take fairly seriously in terms of the risk versus benefit. But the way I talk to my patients about it, and fortunately I had the benefit of having been using these therapies since their inception. I was involved in the early etanercept trials as a resident, actually, believe it or not, and in the late 90s. And I tell patients that, you know, I probably can think of 1 or 2 patients I've stopped the drugs for over the years in my career. So it lets them know that, yeah, like any medication, we're mindful of side effects. I let them know what to look out for, but the serious ones are unlikely to affect our patients. There's a question here about a slide showing secukinumab having a quick onset of action. Why are patients quitting it so early? Yeah, and so I want to caution people about us not overly interpreting that data. That's a smaller study, and shorter-term follow-up. So hard to get a full sense of how that will work when we have thousands of patients being treated across the world. We'll get a better insight into how long people stay on secukinumab or other IL-17 inhibitors. I'd say in general, I think there's 2 types of loss of response I see. People who do really well in induction where they're getting a lot of dose, and then when they're no longer in induction phase, month 6, month 7, month 8, that's when things might sneak back in some patients, you know. And then there's others who are more run-of-the-mill folks who are year 2, year 3 in, and they're losing response. And these are often people who have lost response to multiple drugs. You know, they have declared that their biology is one of respond, lose response. You know, and those are people who I try and be more careful with about cycling through treatment too often. Maybe think about combining methotrexate or other agents to see if I can't get better durability of response over time. All right, so this question wishes us a congratulations on a great program, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
And what do you think about the role of imaging methods such as coronary artery ultrasound or looking at stratification measures such as coronary CT scans? And so I'll say it at University of Pennsylvania, where we have a specialty clinic on cardiovascular prevention, they will often think about using coronary CT scans in people with intermediate risk. You know, the challenge our people with psoriasis face is that they have psoriasis and a whole bunch of other non-traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And so, you know, the average patient out there who doesn't have psoriasis, all the tools are built on those people, not on someone with psoriasis. So as we try to get to more personalized medicine, I think, you know, the more thoughtful clinician, either primary care doctor or preventive cardiologist, will look at someone with bad psoriasis of long-standing disease, maybe has a little metabolic syndrome or central obesity or stress, and say, you know what, I'm not feeling comfortable that my risk prediction model is working well. Like, if they're, let's say their cholesterol looks good, they don't have diabetes, they may say, you know, we still should check a coronary CT scan because that will give us added prognostic information. And so it's important as PAs, dermatologists caring for our patients, we have to start this conversation for our patients so they know to have it. I think in my practice, I've seen some patients over the years, you know, where families were incredibly grateful for us alerting them to these issues. And then when they had a coronary CT scan or they saw their primary doctor, things were intervened on in a way that was able to prevent catastrophic events. Yeah. All right, so then we have a question here. I'll make sure I use the right clicker. All right, so how would you move from an oral medication to secukinumab in a woman who is 42 years old has a BMI of 29? Zhengmi, why don't we start with you? So how would you think about counseling this woman? Let's say she's still with childbearing potential. She's close to obese. Does that factor into whether or not you're going to use 150 dose or 300 milligram dose when using secukinumab?
I tend to go the higher dose if a patient is close to obese. I believe that it will help clear them a little faster and hopefully longer.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly the data shows that the higher dose has better rates of clearance.
Yes.
And the safety profiles are fairly similar, except maybe for yeast infections. They're slightly more prone to yeast infections at a higher dose. That tends to be the one time with a drug like secukinumab, I may say, if you're having trouble with yeast infections, they're not responding to typical over-the-counter stuff on one course of diflucan, fluconazole, you know, maybe we'll try using 150 and see if we can still control your disease that way. The other thing I sort of like about secukinumab in the divided dose is I find in clinical practice some patients need dosing every 2 weeks. You know, if I dose them once a month, whether it be with ixekizumab or any other different drugs that are every 8 weeks or every 12 weeks, they just need dosing more regularly to maintain clearance. And so it's nice to have that flexibility to say, you know, in your individual case, you need dosing every 2 weeks. Let's try secukinumab 150 every 2 weeks. More along the lines of treating the disease of psoriasis in women of childbearing age. Junko, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I think there are two parts to this. So first, in terms of the treatment strategy among women of childbearing age, I definitely don't consider acitretin as a treatment option because of its long half-life. And then methotrexate I will often think twice about, and especially since we have so many other treatment options currently that, you know, we're not really sort of pigeonholed into using methotrexate quite as much as we used to. With regards to treatment during pregnancy, you know, generally try to avoid the systemics and encourage phototherapy. Luckily for us, women during pregnancy tend to have milder psoriasis, though there are certainly cases where that's not the case, and some people actually flare when they're pregnant. But yes, I stick to it originally, or I start with phototherapy and topicals. In more severe cases, you know, I will discuss biologics. They're all pregnancy category B, and in particular, sertolizumab, which is relatively newly approved for psoriasis, doesn't cross the placenta, and so that would be, of the biologics, probably my treatment of choice if I go that route.
I think, you know, I personally love taking care of women at that stage in their life when they're contemplating pregnancy, being a part of that decision-making process for them. And I think it is a really good time for an in-depth discussion. You know, I tell patients that in general, many women, when they get pregnant, their psoriasis will moderate, will get better. And that's reassuring. And I tell them that everyone reads the rule. For a small population of patients, it's the opposite. Their disease may get a little bit worse. And I do talk about the, you know, our biologics, sotalizumab is one pearl because it's a Fab fragment. It's not felt to cross the placenta, and so maybe it's even safer than other ones. But generally what I explained to them is that none of these biologics, they're just antibodies, and none of them we think would really cause problems in the first trimester. And so it's really what we're more worried about around the peripartum period, that, you know, in the third trimester, if it crosses the placenta, the baby can be born and have the biologic on board, maybe be more prone to infections or have issues with live vaccines or what have you. And so usually it's a decision we make with the patient, their family if necessary, and their OB-GYN. Mm-hmm. And most of the OBs, at least in my community, feel pretty comfortable having worked with patients with Crohn's disease or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis about using these therapies when they need to. All right, so we have a lot of great questions coming in, folks. I appreciate them. This one says, excellent program. Thank you for that. Has a patient on apremilast, still has significant plaques. Do you switch or do you add? How long do you try either before changing the plan? So, Zhang-Mi, how long will you keep someone on apremilast before you decide that you've maxed out on the result you're going to get?
I generally try to keep them on for the 16 weeks because that is what the studies showed. So if I have a patient that hasn't achieved a PASI 75 or, you know, clear or almost clear skin, I tend to switch them. I don't add.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So with apremilast, if we try it, they're not having a great response. Instead of adding a biologic or adding phototherapy, one would just say, let's switch to something different.
Usually if I've started them on a systemic medication, I will continue them on a different type of systemic, yeah. Mm-hmm. So probably a biologic.
Yeah. I often find my practice, so a lot of times when I'm using apremilast, it's because they're sort of risk-averse folks. They don't want lab monitoring. They don't want anything injected. A lot of times those people are very open to phototherapy and do quite well in that circumstance. Junko, your take on this case, someone not doing great on apremilast, where would you go?
Yeah, so I mean, it depends on a couple of things. If the patient's pretty miserable while we're, you know, only at month two or three and apremilast and knowing sort of the clinical trial data, and they're willing to switch, I might switch them sooner, mm-hmm. Knowing that it has moderate efficacy to begin with. And so I don't necessarily wait until the sort of 16 weeks unless the patient has a really strong preference to stay on orals and avoid injectables.
All right, so we only have a few minutes left. I'm going to maybe try and have us close with this last question, which is about when do you refer a patient to a rheumatologist? You know, beginning to come about joint pains, it takes so long to get an appointment. This is a real challenge, right? As hard as to see a dermatologist, that much harder to see a rheumatologist. And oftentimes when I talk to my colleagues in rheumatology who are experts, they'll say, who should we send you to see who has psoriasis? Anyone with joint pain. And that's, I'm glad for the enthusiasm, but practically that's really challenging. And also a lot of my patients don't want to see another doctor or it's a burden for them from copays and whatnot. So the algorithm I use in my mind is one is I try and figure out what do they have. You know, they have classic inflammatory joint symptoms. If I'm examining their fingers and pressing on their MCPs or DIPs or PIPs and getting a lot of tenderness in those areas, but no tenderness, say, in a fleshy part, a forearm, which would indicate more fibromyalgia. If they have multiple joints involved, if they have stiffness that's more than 30 to 60 minutes, I'll start the workup. I'll get a CRP to look for measure for inflammation in the blood. I'll get a rheumatoid factor and a CCP antibody. Occasionally, I picked up some rheumatoid arthritis in my practice. So when these things come up positive, that's when the phone call comes, you gotta get this person in. But if everything's sort of negative and it's sort of the symptoms are kind of mild, we could sit on it a little bit and see rheumatology when they're able to see them. It's also simple to get x-rays of affected hands and feet. Again, if the radiologist picks up joint damage, that would be a place to know that they really need to go on to rheumatology. Anything to add to that, Junko?
Yeah, I have a very similar approach. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, if some of this workup comes back indicating psoriatic arthritis, I won't necessarily always wait for the patient to see a rheumatologist to start a biologic, even with suspicion potentially, especially if the psoriasis is severe and will lean towards a treatment that is approved for psoriatic arthritis or more efficacious for PSA.
So we've also had a number of questions about triggers of psoriasis, of flares of psoriasis, and this comes up with my patients a lot. They want to know, should they be eating less gluten, or should they be eating more gluten? Depends on what the latest thing that went on the on social media came out as. You know, for me, I talk to my patients a lot about stress management. You know, there's an epidemic of anxiety in our culture right now. Having psoriasis itself is stressful. I talk about mindfulness meditation as one practice that in some studies has been shown to modulate psoriasis, make it less active or respond better to treatment. So I think managing stress is important, trying to minimize infections, not by overly hand washing, but by just being regular vaccines, things of that nature. Zhang Mei, any top tips you have for avoiding flares of psoriasis?
Compliance with medication, number one. But yes, I do definitely agree. I mean, staying clear of infections. I don't normally offer any dietary suggestions. The information that's out there, there's no like heavy science behind it. So
I think the best I always tell patients that having a healthy body weight is the most important thing. I don't encourage people to restrict their diet in any way, shape, or form beyond having a heart-healthy diet and trying to maintain a good, healthy body mass. And I love your comment, Zhang Mei, about one way to prevent flares is by adherence to your medication. That's a really good pearl. Sometimes the most simple and obvious things are things we miss out on a lot. So I thank you for bringing that up. Well, listen, I want to thank my faculty for joining us and for all you joining us today for CME Outfitters' 100th video streaming event and for their help in developing this educational activity. And finally, thank you, our audience, who took the time out of your very busy day to learn ways to improve the care of patients with psoriasis. I'm Dr. Joel Gelfand. I hope you are able to incorporate some of the recommendations we provide for you into your optimal care of your patients.